the date today? Is it the 14th of July?
I think it is, yes.
Yeah. And my name's Therese Sweeney, and I'm... Who am I interviewing today?
You're interviewing Max Dunby.
Max Dunby, is that your full name?
No, Maxwell John Rowland, I was christened. Born on the 3rd of February 1938 at Kilford. Moved to Liverpool in second class, which I think was about 1945, thereabouts. And went to Liverpool Primary School, and later I went to Newington College.
So your parents' full names?
Roland Albert, my father's name, and my mother's name was Violet Palmer Brown, before she was married.
And you had any brothers and sisters?
No, I'm the only child.
Only child. So you grew up where? Were you born where?
I was born in Guildford, and I grew up in Liverpool. Guildford was during the war. My father went to the war. We lived in a cottage in 463 Woodville Road, Guildford. And my father was an iceman before the war and used to pick up his ice from Guildford Iceworks and Liverpool Iceworks, and subsequently had a relationship with a Mr. Green that owned the iceworks, who I think was a former mayor of Liverpool, actually, and who told him if he'd come back to the war, he'd sell him the iceworks. Mr. Green was quite ill. Sent for him, he got home on compassionate leave, and Mr. Green laid the money to buy the iceworks. That's what happened.
Where did your dad grow up?
I think he grew up in Enfield, around near that area. You know.
And your mum?
Auburn and Croydon Park.
So you're quite local, really, southwest.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. What do you remember as a little kid at Guildford and your dad's business, the iceworks?
Well, he never had the iceworks when we were in Guildford. That's not quite true. He, as I remember him doing an ice run, I remember going with him to Ingleburn Army Camp, you know, at the start of the war when I was, you know, 3 or 4 or something. And and then when he went overseas, I remember him going overseas in Air Force Blues and returning one day in jungle greens with a ginger moustache. I didn't know him. So a couple of years later, you see. So, but as far as business was concerned, my mother, when he bought the iceworks, he was still in the army, in the air force, and my mother ran the iceworks, and subsequently until he returned from the war.
So
then they built a house on the opposite corner in Christie Street, Liverpool, and we moved there when I was about 7. Went to school at Liverpool Primary School.
So what business? So he had the iceworks. What was that business? Describe.
Well, he was an ice manufacturer in those days before our households had refrigeration. We produced ice there. He subsequently built another ice works in Ingleburn. We would have trucks, had about 13 three-ton odd trucks to deliver ice every day all the way in the district. I've served ice in Austral, in the back of a jeep and trailer. I've served ice in Hargrove Park in a jeep and trailer. In Austral, it was necessary because the roads weren't formed. We drove down between the trees in the mud to deliver people ice because there was no sealed roads. At Hargrove Park, which was the housing settlement after the war, down near Warwick Farm there for people that never had accommodation. It was the old army camp. In fact, it was Hargrove's airfield originally, I think. Other areas where there were roads you could traverse, the trucks went.
So it was quite a lot, big area to cover, really.
Oh yes, it was all of Liverpool as we know it, except we never got to Wallachia and Warragamba. That was from the iceworks in Penrith, I think.
So how was that? That was a private business.
Yes.
And his own initiative.
Oh, yes. Well, it had been started. There were many iceworks in those days. There was one in Fairfield, Liverpool, Merrylands, Guildford, Granville, a big one in Granville. The Green family, who was a cousin of the guy that had it in Liverpool, had a big show down in that area. That was the business. And then later it was sold to a fellow called Bernie Porter. That's when I went to high school, and my father built Hollywood Motors.
So just with the iceworks, can you describe what a delivery would be and how much it would cost, for example, if you were delivering to a family?
If you're delivering to a family, we endeavoured as ice manufacturers to sell 4 blocks of ice a week to a house. And we served ice on Monday, Wednesday, Friday and Saturday. Sometimes you only get half a block in on Friday or half a block in on Saturday. At the conclusion of that, I remember ice was 1 penny a block, 1 shilling and 1 penny a block. So it was costing them 4 and 4 pence a week to have ice put in their chest. My father had vendors who bought the ice at 50% of that, and they ran their own truck. He also had a system where he used to lease trucks to people for £1 a day, and we got our petrol from Pat Cullen, 13 and 4 for 4 gallons, and they're the price that I can remember.
So how did the back of the truck look?
Back of the truck looked, there's a picture of it in there, I'll show you. Back of the truck was there was a enclosed body on the back of the truck. It was a sign written that was to keep the ice, the sun off the ice. The moulds that we made the ice in were what we called 100 weights, but they were in fact heavier than 100 weight. They were 132 pounds, and that was to allow a bit of loss in the wagon before you deliver it to the customer. So they were cut into blocks of a quarter, which should have been 28 pounds.
So you have quite a good memory of that. You were...
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep.
How long were you in the back of the trucks for yourself helping out?
I wasn't actually in the back of the trucks, but
I
later took over the iceworks from my father after Porter, the fellow that bought the business, committed suicide, poisoned himself actually, and subsequently hadn't been paid for, and we got it back. And my father was running Hollywood Motors, and I went up there with 20 quid in my pocket to take over the old trucks or whatever. And I lasted there until. It lasted until Christmas of 1970, from the 1st of July 1957 till we served ice on the Christmas Day of 1960, and within pulled down a service station built, which I operated, Ampole Service Station, the corner of Christie Street. And when Beverly and I got married in March 1960, we lived in the house across the road. My father moved out and went to live in the squash courts.
At Liverpool Squash Courts?
Yes. He subsequently had built the squash courts. When he built the squash courts, it was the highest, it was the only three-storey building in Liverpool.
So let's talk about Hollywood Motors. What location was that?
That's on the Hume Highway.
I remember it.
Basically opposite, just up in the corner of the Hoxton Park Road there. It's now a big intersection. We were Morris dealers, and we were Plymouth dealers, and we sold motorbikes and push bikes, and had an Ampol service station, a workshop at the rear. It was quite a going business. Pictures of that's in there.
So you went into, so from ice you went in, you moved into sort of moving vehicles.
Well, my father moved into. He sold the iceworks to Porter, built Hollywood Motors, was operating it. Porter had his demise. I left school to work in the dealership. I went from there to the iceworks and ran it independently. And then subsequently my father sold the Hollywood Motors to a fellow called Bill Presland. His family, I think, still own it. I'm not sure. They own the site. They pulled it down. They own the site.
So you went to Newington College.
I did.
And what was that like? Board there, or were you?
No, I was a day boy.
Yeah.
A day boy. I used to catch the.
So it's a stand boy, yeah.
Yeah, I caught the steam train in Liverpool in the morning to Strathfield, and then got on all stations to Stanwell and walked to school and come home the same way.
Because there wouldn't have been many of you on that train going in, would there? Going to school.
There was about there was about eight boys going to Newington from Liverpool, Campbelltown and Ingleburn and Glenfield.
Do you still have any contact with any of those men?
Yes, I do. one was a chap called Peter Lamanis, whose father owned the theatre in Liverpool, George Lamanis' son. I haven't seen Graham, Nigel or John Wells for some years. There was a chap called Boris Bobby Ref and Owen Knott from Campbelltown. So there was quite a few. But later, there were quite a few went later after me too.
So your dad became mayor of Liverpool. Your dad was mayor of Liverpool.
He was, yes.
Will we talk about that for a bit? You have memories of that.
Yes, I do. My father was stood for council. I think it was in 1948, and was elected mayor the first night in council. Very unusual. First night.
how did that come about?
Well, the long story. There was the current mayor was a fellow called Bernie Fitzpatrick, and my father went to talk to him about it. He told him he hadn't been in the district long enough. He shouldn't stand. And that was the red rag of the bull. So the old fellow formed the Labour Party branch in Liverpool, actually, and it was a six-hall council, and he came out of the hat and beat Joe Bradshaw for mayor. And that's not quite right. He beat Fitzpatrick for mayor the first time, and later on he beat Joe Bradshaw out of the hat. But that was another story.
So Fitzpatrick was the, because I know the Fitzpatricks. They were the four. I know they were a mayor at some point. That was before your father.
That was Bernie Fitzpatrick lost the job to my father. The Fitzpatricks were quite a large family in Liverpool. They had the butcher shop, they had a bakery, they had a fruit shop, a fruit shop and produce merchants. They were pretty active in the town.
So what was Liverpool like then as a town around that time?
Well, I remember doing a project at school in the sixth class, and the population was 7,000. The main street was sealed because it was the old Hume Highway. Northumberland Street, Bathurst Street, Castlereagh Street weren't sealed. I think George Street wasn't sealed either. It was sealed pretty soon after that.
Now,
so the dirt roads.
There's a report here you've given me a few weeks ago on a copy of the mayor report.
Yes.
So you gave me that for a reason.
Well, I said to you, that's a bit of history of the town and or of my father's involvement. It's his first mayoral report, and it talks about all sorts of things and what they managed to achieve and what they did, what they set out to do. The council election was actually deferred for a year. It was due to be held in 1947. It was put off to 1948 because of the amalgamation of councils that the government of the day had ordered. And the Nepean Shire was sliced into three sections, A, B and C riding. One went to Canberra, one went to Penrith and one went to Liverpool. And that's why Liverpool is such a long, narrow area now that goes right out to and including the other side of the Nepean River there at Wallachia. That was part of Nepean Shire. Nepean Shire came right in to Miller's Bridge, just near what's now the Liverpool Catholic Club. That was all part of the Nepean Shire.
So do you remember seeing your dad as mayor? You went into the mayor offices, did you?
Oh, yeah.
What are some of the memories?
Well, I can tell you some funny stories. But
can you share one of them?
Well, I can remember one night in the council meeting that there was two aldermen got stuck into it, and Bill Stanton jumped on the back of Joe Bradshaw and had him round the throat and was punching him in the ear, and the father adjourned the meeting. I was in the gallery, and my father adjourned the meeting, and took him outside and calmed him down and brought him back in, and then started the meeting again. And Ernie Smith, an alderman there, stood up in his Scottish brogue and said, "Mr. Mayor, I move that the fight be recommenced," which was like having the matter resubmitted, you see. But that was a funny night. But however, I remember. Every Sunday night in the very early days, my father would go to the council chambers, and I would go with him. I was only about 10 or something. to see the engineer every Sunday night. Joe McGowan was his name. And they would sit there and they would determine what footpaths were to be concreted by the gang of the day. It was a fellow called Sid English. What footpaths would be concreted, what gutters would be concreted, what grades would be, what roads would be graded, what grass would be cut, all that sort of stuff. I mean, so it's a vast change from those days of a small country town compared to what it is today.
So how long was your dad mayor?
I'm not sure exactly. I think he was mayor seven times, and there was breaks in between it, that sort of thing. Might have been seven or eight times, something like that. Yeah. He went into Parliament first of May 1965, representing the seat in the Peon, which included Campbelltown, a bit of Liverpool and Penrith. And that seat was cut up, and a new seat of Campbelltown was formed, and I ran for pre-selection for that, and I was successful, and I was a member for Campbelltown from 1968 to 1971, and we were both defeated in the 1971 election, so it was a bit of a trying time.
So that was state parliament?
Yes.
So you stood for Campbelltown because you were living...
I stood for Campbelltown because my father was living in Nepean and wanted to stay in Nepean, and I moved to Campbelltown and ran for pre-selection and was successful.
So you were interested in politics. You were an active man.
Well, you know, it's sort of, you know, I sort of grew up with it in the sense that it'd be talked about around the kitchen table all the time. And come election time, I'd be delivering, particularly around Austral and those places, brochures and things off the back of a horse. You know, out Hoxton Park and Austral and Preston's and all those sort of places. So I guess it was in the blood. I ran for council. I was actually on the council in 1966. I was elected to council before I became a member of Parliament.
That's Campbelltown Council.
Liverpool Council. Because the seat of Campbelltown included a fair bit of Liverpool. The seat of Campbelltown went out to, well, if you start at Warragamba and come down Park Road to Ludnam and then down the Elizabeth Drive to Kemp's Creek and along Devonshire Road to Hoxton Park Road and or Fourth Avenue, what would you like, and down to Bringelly Road and then across and down the highway to Crossroads, and from there round George's River and taking Campbelltown, a straight line up over the Razorback with Miss Picton, and then follow around from that back to Warragamba. That was the seat of Campbelltown when I was elected.
So it would have been bushland, most of it, yeah? Like, what sort of...
It certainly wasn't anything like it is today. I mean, I remember, I door knocked the two streets of the new subdivision in Campbelltown, in Greenacres Avenue or whatever up there, and that was the new area of Campbelltown. I mean, it's vast today compared to what it was then. Certainly, there was a lot of bush between the back of Ingleburn, and it was a village. It was a small town, and so too was Glenfield, Macquarie Field, Lemire, and those places.
You would have seen a bit of territory on your horse then. So you're a good horseman.
Not anymore.
But you were.
I could ride. I used to go to shows and gymkhanas and compete in flag races and all that sort of stuff as a kid, but not of late. I mean, the last time I got on a horse, I couldn't work out. We bought a couple of properties in the bush and they were pretty steep, and I couldn't work out what was wrong. My father couldn't get around, and I couldn't understand it, you know. Anyhow, I went on this horse this day, riding down from in the Wurrung State Forest into a bit of country out down below, and the old horse started to play up, and I had my right stirrup almost on the ground, the left stirrup was about 6 foot off the ground, and the horse was starting to rear up, and I got off and I realised what his problem was. It took me 25 years to work it out, but I worked it out.
So as a young person growing up, what were your activities, like, aside from working, which it sounds like you did a bit of?
I did a bit of that. I was a bike rider, and I used to train of a night along Hoxton Park Road and then along Elizabeth Drive and out to my father. He was a pretty good bike rider, and he thought I was going to be a world champion, you know, the usual thing. and he used to follow me in the lights, and I'd be training. This was, you know, when I was in in high school, out to the Western Highway and back again along Wargrave Road, and there's a drive and back home of a night, did a scene like that. Or I'd ride between Liverpool and Campbelltown and Narellan and back down the M Highway, you know, for a Saturday morning sort of thing. You know, that was all part of the training thing, you know.
What sort of bike did you ride?
I rode Melbourne Stars, which was the same bike that my father rode professionally for Bruce Small of Own Melbourne Star. Bruce Small was later the mayor of the Gold Coast, yeah. And I still have one of his bikes actually, and I rode the Melbourne Stars. We were selling Melbourne Stars, and I rode Melbourne Star, and I rode in the Camden Bike Club. I won a country championship there, and then New South Wales Country Championship, and then I couldn't get enough competition in Liverpool. I went to Canterbury Bankstown, which used to race at the old Wiley Park track, which is now pulled down. Had a couple of bad pranks there, and that was sort of the end of that.
How old were you when you sort of ceased?
Sorry, when I ceased?
Well,
how old was I?
Or how long were you at it for?
Oh, I was at it for about 5 years, I suppose. Yeah.
So
I was a juvenile, then a junior, and then I retired. Yes. I didn't become a senior.
Yes.
The seniors were at 18, and I started younger than that. So.
Any other riders you remember locally that you'd ride with back then?
Oh, I rode with fellows up here, a chap called John Lee and Digger Hamer, and those blokes in the Camden Bike Club. I remember them quite well. The Liverpool Bike Club was pretty amateurish. I remember we used to race down near the Warwick Farm racecourse there, up to where there's now a bridge going across the river, and go up and turn around and go up round the houses up and the stables up the other end of the Warwick, towards the highway, where Ingham's have got it now, or Ingham's had a big complex there. And we raced there, had a few bad pranks there too, but that's another story.
So when you say pranks, you come off your bike? Or hit cars, or
no, just bike. Come off the bike.
Not many cars around.
Well, there's cars that stop when you're racing. Well, those days, anyhow. I had a bad fall there at Warwick Farm, and a fella called Tatum hit me, and when I fell, hit me, and he went up into the fence of the railway line and broke both collarbones. He was been knocked around more than me. I took top off the left one of their shoulder a bit. At Wiley Park, I had a bad prank. I managed one night to go over the top of the fence and upside down straight to the door of the ambulance room. Still strapped in the bike, so there you go.
So the highlight of your career was the country state championship?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, it's pretty good, isn't it?
No, it wasn't too bad.
Better than
anything. Well, it wasn't, you know, it was a dirt track, actually, at Camden, on the old shade man. But, yeah.
So, just thinking where we go from here. So you met, what age did you meet your wife? And she grew up near the Costas, didn't she? Her land. You want to talk about her family?
Yeah, Beverly's father and mother were Nelson, Hazel, Phyllis. They owned a property bounded by Cow Pasture Road, I think North Liverpool Road, and Wilson Road, and the creek near the Hoxton Park there. Nelson was a cattle dealer. Beverly invited me out actually in 1956, and we got married in 1960.
So where was she schooled?
She was schooled at Hoxton Park Primary School, and then she went to, I think it was Homebush Girls High, I think.
Bit of travel there too for her.
Well, she just board with her grandmother who lived down that way.
And how many siblings has Beverly got?
Beverly's got three other sisters.
Are they all still alive?
Yes. All still married too.
Well, that's a miracle, isn't it? Really?
It is a bit.
So you've had 50 years of marriage?
Yeah, we have, yeah. We've clocked the 50 years up. On the 12th of March last year.
So where were you married?
Married St Luke's at Liverpool.
And was it a big wedding?
It was a big wedding, actually, yeah.
Can you talk about some of the people?
The reception was in the town hall. A lot of... It's a long while ago. Yes. I can't remember everybody was there. I mean, I really can't, but there's a lot of people there, I can tell you that.
And did you go away on a honeymoon?
Yeah, we went to Hayman Island. And how things have changed. We caught a first plane from Sydney. I think it was a Viscount, and it went to Brisbane. And then we caught an Electra from Brisbane to Mackay. And there was a DC-3 from Mackay to Proserpine, and a cage from Proserpine to Chute Harbour, and then a launch, and we all sat in the back of the launch with our feet against the cans of milk in the middle of the launch to get to Hayman Island. We left in the early in the morning and got there in dark. And we went back to Hayman Island some years ago, and we managed to fly to Mackay and get helicopters. So it was all over in a couple of hours. So that's how things have changed in transport in that period of time.
So, at the time of your marriage, what were you working in? What business were you running?
I was running the iceworks. I had been running the iceworks. And, as I said, we served ice on the Christmas, and we pulled it down then. And I still had a facility, a cool room built further down. I was still serving ice and what have you, and had a vending machine for people to put their... In those days, 2 shillings in the slot for a block of ice. It got up from 1 penny in that 10-year, 15-year period. And we operated the service station. And then I became a Chrysler dealer and built W Motors next door, which is now McGrath's.
So when the ice, I'm just naively asking here, but the ice that you buy at service stations...
That's crushed ice.
Yes. That had nothing to do... Did you... was there any connection?
Yeah, certainly is. I mean, technology's changed. When we produced ice, it was produced in moulds in a tank that was full of brine around the moulds, and the refrigerant was in the coils around the moulds. These days, it can produce very differently, and I used to crush some ice for Ingham's in the early days for their chicken plant, but these days you can either produce it that way, or I think there are machines that produce ice in the form of crushed ice, if you like, and bag. And it's a very good business, and we maybe should have stayed in it, but we didn't. But that's history.
Why did you get out of the business?
I had a severe accident there. I was bleeding in refrigeration. The secret is to force the liquid through a very small aperture, and it becomes a gas, and that's the point of freezing. Your household fridge is the same as a hot bit and a cold bit. That's what happened. If your compressor is leaking a bit of oil, then you bleed the oil out of the system, and I was bleeding the oil out of the system, and a pipe broke, and I got covered in it. I retreated, rang the fire brigade. They put me in an army greatcoat and what have you, and they put me on the end of a rope and a fire hose, and I went in there trying to shut the gas off, and I couldn't shut it off. Eventually I got it shut down, but I blocked the EMI while I was doing that, and I got burnt in the throat pretty bad. And I still pay a bit of an effect of that. I got burnt around the knees and the liquid. So the family decision was made, get rid of the ice works. It was too old, and the plant was too old, and it was a declining business. It was allowed, in that form.
And to upgrade it would have been too much.
Pardon?
Well, anyway, you decided to get out of that.
We got
business.
Out. We sold it. We sold the land to Ampol, and they built the service station. I leased it and operated it.
Okay. So that was next door to Dunbier Motors.
Based on the corner of Christie Street, and then I subsequently bought the other blocks towards Riley Street and built the showroom and UK out there.
So what is it about cars that you like?
Pardon me, excuse me. What is it about cars I like? I don't know, they're very expensive today compared to what they used to be. I like a good motor car, but I don't know. I guess, nothing more than anyone else.
So you mentioned what you sold. And can you talk a bit about how good business was? Like, I mean, it would have been kind of an, would have been on the increase because population in Liverpool was increasing.
No, it was. We were selling Morris's, Morris Miners, Oxford's, Morris Isis and that sort of thing. Yes, yeah. The Holden came out, and that was really that was the big thing. And McGrath got that franchise, and then Pat Cullen got it. So there was two Holden deals in Liverpool. So, but prior to that, the Morris Miner and Morris Oxford were a pretty good little motor car for their day. I got a bit involved in the sporting scene. I was the youngest competitor in the Ampol trial around Australia in 1957. Drove a Morris Minor up the Birdsville track. That was the experience. I had a navigator called Tom Popple. I think Tom's still alive. Poor old Tom ran halfway between Maori and Birdsville because you would hit a sand hill, and I had coir mats to put down to drive onto, and he'd take the ones from the back and put them in the front, and then we'd get on a salt pan, away we'd go the next end ridge, and Tom'd be running again. He did a fantastic job, Tommy Popple. Anyhow, that was 1957, yeah.
So how long you have your motors business for? What are some of the moments in that motor industry that you can reflect on that?
Was
it successful, the business?
It was okay, yeah. Eventually I sold it to at least the property to Chrysler, because I was in the parliament. He couldn't do both, And subsequently sold it to him later on. Yeah.
So what portfolio did you have in Parliament?
I didn't have a portfolio, I was a backbencher.
And what years were that?
1968 to 71, inclusive.
So who was in Parliament?
Askin was the Premier.
Interesting times.
Yeah, it was interesting times. I don't believe half the garbage I hear about it either.
Yeah. But what was good for you? What sort of drove you politically? Then?
Well, I think most people go in a palm and go there because they think they can do some good for somebody, and that's what it was about. I had an interest in the town and the community, and thought I could do things for it, and that's what it was about.
So do you see anything what was your contribution as a parliamentarian, do you think, for the local community?
You don't get a lot of opportunity as a junior backbencher to make a big contribution. Yeah. You certainly try and put the pressure on ministers for various things about, safer railway crossings and the likes of Minto and the expressway. I remember, I don't know how many times I asked questions in the Parliament about the expressway to Pat Morton, and privately to Pat Morton, who was then the minister. Eventually, it was sections of it were built. I have some regrets about some things, namely that we never managed to achieve a hospital in my term in Campbelltown, and that was largely due with the minister of the day, who had quite an ego, Philip Harry Jago. He told me he didn't want another pressure group annoying him in the formation of a hospital board. So that's the biggest regret I got.
So where did you go to from cars? Because you've got quite a big business, really.
I went into transport.
What was the motivation there?
I was selling Dodge trucks, and quite a lot of them. And there was no dealer in Camden, and I sold a lot of trucks on the coal in Camden. And I had a lot of trade-ins, and then I couldn't get rid of the trade-ins. So eventually I got permission to put some of these trucks back on the road, and I became a contractor. In the Murray Valley.
So what was your thinking in conceptualising your business? Like, why did you go into trucks? What moved you there?
I think it was just a natural progression for me. When I had the iceworks, I had taxi trucks. And I used to go to the army sales and ticket me out for hire and all that sort of stuff. And I remember I had a green plate, which is not exactly left in these days. That was a number plate that allowed you to take passengers with your goods. And I used to sit on the rank alongside Sydney Town Hall, or I'd go down to the wharf and the boats were coming in, and and all the Blue Ridge set would have their trunks, and they'd deliver their trunks out to the north side of the river, you know. And they delivered fridges for STC. Well, that's, you know, STC was a factory at Liverpool there on the water, on the river.
So that was when all the orchids were there and they had a lot of fruit there at the time, yeah? Is that STC? Was it?
STC are Standard Telephones and Cables.
Cables.
See, so the big employers in the town in those days was cable makers, STC, and I can't think of the name of there.
So why cables? What was the attraction, do you think, for those big businesses here?
The attraction was, I guess, it was available. It was power and water and labour, and you know, they came out to that area because they had no relevant mascot in those places in those days. The same thing's happening again today. They're moving out. That's why you get this industrial area at Minto and Campbelltown and Ingleburn and so on.
So how long have you been here at Narellan?
We moved to Narellan before the election of 1968. Moved to Campbelltown, sorry, before the election of 1968, and then lived in a house that we owned in Queen Street, Campbelltown, Main Street, and then subsequently moved to a property called Camden Fields on the Narellan Road over here, just over the hill, which is now all housing. And then I moved here to build this house 25 years ago.
So there's quite a lot going on around you at the moment.
Yeah, we're being attacked from every side. There's housing over here behind us, and there's housing down here, and there's housing over there. And there's industrial up outside the front, so yes, we're being surrounded.
So how do you feel about that?
Don't mind.
Yeah.
I don't mind the industrial side because I think it's good security. You know, it's got progress. You live with progress. Mm.
So what do you run today? What sort of businesses do you run today?
I run two coal preparation plants, and I've got 20 trucks at Narellan carting coal and or reject or road base or whatever, and I've got half a dozen in a business in Mudgee, and basically that's it, I suppose. Yeah.
So what was the trick? You've got a property at Mudgee. It's a lovely spot. I was there a few weeks ago.
No, I've got a property at Cooler.
Oh, Cooler.
North of Mudgee.
Yeah.
And I've got one at near Scone, and one at Denman.
So what was the attraction there? Just.
Well, originally, you know, always liked horses and cattle, that sort of thing. And my father and I had a place at Wombin Caves, pretty rough block, but it was not bad country in places. And towards Taralga there, and then we went from there to Cooler in 1973. So we've been there basically. It's not the same property, but been there since. Been going, of course, in 1973.
It's a lovely area, isn't it?
It's a good area.
It's a good area.
Yep.
So can I just go back to your trucking and some of your big clients? Like, what were you delivering back then? You mentioned.
Well, we were carting coal in for people in the Bargering Valley, which was started by the Clinton family and Stan Fox, two separate organisations. So they became Clutha. So we're operating for Clutha. Clutha subsequently was privatised, sold to BP first. And they shut all of the plants down. At the time, I was a contractor operating big dumpers at the Glenlea washery. The place was shut down. I eventually convinced Clutha to let me reopen it personally as a contractor, which I did. Then subsequently, after Clutha's demise and me being involved in a couple of coal mines and getting out and lose a lot of money in one of them, I bought Glenlea, and that's our base now. That's where we operate from.
What changes have you seen in the coal industry? And it's a big question.
I've seen the demise of the Bowering Valley, which is very sad, but it ran out of coal. I mean, the Warragamba Dam is what brought about the demise of the Bowering Valley, basically. It could have been extended to the other side of the valley, but you couldn't do it because of the dam and the water board catchment area and that sort of thing. So basically, they mined one side of the valley. It was a huge valley and a huge producer of coal. The first exporter of coal to Japan came to the Murray Valley. Bill Clinton was there, was the man that organised it.
So when did it close?
Oh, about 6 years ago, I think, basically, yeah. I've still got a washery out there, and we're doing the rehabilitation of the washery and reprocessing what been thrown away previously. New technology, you get a product out. I get about 1,000 ton a day out of it at the moment, and we're in the throes of probably about another 4 or 5 years, and we'll be finished, totally finished. And try to get it back to as close to nature as we can get it to.
So, can you talk about that process?
Which process?
Okay, so are you saying you're re-washing?
Yep. Well, if you go back when they first produced after the war coal for export, it was exported raw. Then it had to have the be washed, and by washing you take mostly taking impurities out of it, mainly rock, clay and rock, and that was done with sort of a simple method. And the market at the time, the Japanese particularly, wanted what they call 6% ash coal, which was about 6% impurity in the coal. Therefore, you threw away a lot of coal trying to achieve that result. So there's a big heap out there. It's about 11 million tonnes. And it is a big heap. There's several big dams and so on full of this coal. So we've been with a change in technology and a flotation process. Flotation means basically using reagents and what have you, and magnetite to change the specific gravity of the water, and then the coal is floated and forms bubbles, a bit like the gold industry. And then it's swept off, and then it's dried, and it becomes a pure product. And that's what I'm doing.
And that's good work.
Oh yeah, that's good work. Yeah. I've got about 106 employees altogether.
So where does that coal go? Where are you distributing that?
Well, because it's not prime coal. It's a product. It's a recycled product, if you like. We sell it to other coal companies who burn it with their coal. Goes to various parts of the world.
Okay. And what, so that's, you've been in the industry, the coal industry, for how long again? For years?
Oh, I don't know, 66, I suppose. Started transporting coal about 1966, I think. So, that's whatever the time that is, it was 34.
So you've been quite involved at 40 that time.
Years.
You were doing a few things.
Yeah.
You always got to do a few things.
I was a fringe dweller.
Fringe dweller. Yeah.
Well, they're around of mine. I was doing it, providing ancillary services, so I was a fringe dweller, if you like.
Yeah, that's what.
Then I got to, eventually, there was a mining administration down at Helensburg, and it's called Metropolitan Colliery. It's the oldest colliery in Australia. And it was closed down under administration, and the men were being put off and so. Anyhow, I managed to borrow some money and mortgage my socks, and I reopened the mine. And subsequently, it went very well, and I sold it to XL Coal, who subsequently sold it to Peabody. And,
Interesting.
What's that?
I think that's interesting.
Oh.
So, politically, like, just there's a sense of, are you still kind of committed to,
so,
well, I mean, the Labor Party's changed quite significantly, but are you still a Labor Party person?
No, I'm not a Labor Party person. I was elected as a Liberal.
Were you?
Aye. Oh,
okay. So yeah. When you're handing out pamphlets, you were handing out Liberal pamphlets when you were a kid?
No, I handed out Labor pamphlets when I was a kid.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, how things change?
My father changed,
So was it business that changed you? I mean, I'm not neither here nor there on it. I'm just
What changed me, you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I guess I followed the family instinct, but my father changed, and that was a long, long story. It concerns what's called Catholic action. I don't particularly want to get into that. In the Labor Party. But it's a long story.
Okay. So what else can we talk about, Max?
I don't know.
I mean, you've lived a lot, you've seen a lot.
I've seen a bit and enjoyed it so far. A bit sick of the aching knees at the moment and all the creaks and groans that come with being 72. But,
who are some of your great mates that you've had from the area? You've got some good family friends of you and your wives. I mean, you're probably private people, I would imagine, too.
Well, we've been pretty close, mainly to our family. I mean, Bev's sisters. Bev has, as I said, three sisters, three brother-in-laws. Actually, three of us in Liverpool Rugby Club. Laurie Nelson and John Williams and I was in the Rugby Club. The other, Ron Mead, lives over at Sutherland Way. So we've been pretty close with them and other people. I mean, people in Radfring and people in the... Previously, I'd been in the Lions Club. I was president of the Lions in 1966. And as you say, you just build lifelong friends and, you know, up here. People like the late Gordon Featherplace was a great mate of mine, and Bruce Ferguson, it just passed away as the mayor of Camden. You know, they were particularly close friends of mine.
And you've got children yourself?
I've got five sons.
Do you want to name them for me?
Keith, Ronald, Philip, Peter, and Dave. Four of them work in the business. One lives in Sydney, a solicitor. The other four I'm pretty close to because I see them every day. Yeah.
And you've got grandchildren?
I've got 12 grandchildren and 2 great-grandchildren.
So, what's the family business today?
The family business today is coal preparation. We still operate the coal plant at Helensburg. Even though I sold the mine, we operate the plant. I'm operating the plant at Wallandilly. And we're selling coal and marketing it and we're transporting, and basically transport's our main goal.
I think I spoke with Benny Millat, drove your trucks maybe, did he?
Yeah, could have, yes, Benny, yes, he did. There's a bin, we just pulled it down at Wallandilly, it's called Benny's Bin. He used to operate the bin, he wasn't about to load them, so yeah. He drove for Cleethor, and then he drove for us, I think, when I had Cam McCullough and Bob Hawley's, yeah. So, yeah.
Can you remember some of your early employees, some of their names?
Yeah, the first employee I employed is still alive. Like all that. Well, Bruce Les Starr. That was 1st July 1957. Les worked with me at the service station with father, and he came with me. And there was a couple of other guys up there at the time. Tommy Jones, he's dead, I think, and otherwise, name I can't remember. But my first employee was when I was in sixth class. And the vendor that used to operate the Moorbank run, and I happened to go with him now and again, knew the run, and he left. And I my father said, you know, you better go and chase the run. I said, well, I'll school holidays, I'll hire the truck off you and buy the ice as the vendor, and I used to. So, and I hired a bloke, and I'm just trying to think of his name. I think it was Buck Pitt, and his surname. And so I bought the ice for £2.03 and sold for a tonne, and sold it for £4.68, and paid me 13 and a fourpence for the petrol, and hired the truck for £1 a day and made some money. So that was my first employee.
Well, at the age of 11 or something.
Yeah, about that. Yeah.
So, I'm really, the ice business is really interesting. Like, I just find it visually very interesting to think what the landscape must have been like travelling around in those trucks.
And well, it was certainly different. And you know, yeah. Put it this way. Of all the people that deliver things to houses, the newspaper man throws it over the fence, the milkman puts it on the front step and picks up the money. You know, the guy in those days was selling fence closed props, would sing out closed props, and there'd be a tripe man singing out for tripe, and someone else selling rabbits, and the bread would be delivered. The iceman went inside the kitchen, right? And boy, didn't you see some things in those kitchens.
You went into people's homes.
Absolutely, and you went right inside. Of all the trades, of all the delivery people, you were the one that went right into the kitchen. You know, and some of them were spotless, and some of them were putrid. But, you know, that's life, isn't it?
So, what were some of, like, because the farming would have, you would have gone to farms that were quite, a lot of land.
Lot of 5-acre farms in Liverpool. A lot of market gardeners, a lot of tomato growers. In Moorbank, the same. Orchards in Moorbank. There was a lot of orchards. A lot of them were small poultry farms established after the war, after the First World War, sorry, and had been closed down. But there were people that lived in chook sheds that had hessian put over them and painted with lime, whatever, you know, and I lived in them, and I served ice in them. Yeah. I can remember serving ice over here in Eastwood Road, I think it was Leppington,
yeah.
Eastwood Road, and stepping, there was a place made out of tomato steaks and hessian and what have you, and of course to make it a bit higher, he dug it out the bottom, and I went there one day, it had been raining, and I stepped in about 12 inches of water. You know, but that's the people lived and they put up with that, and they did that, and they owned it, and they built it themselves. These days, people want, you know, a two-story house, a boat, and the caravan in the backyard, and the three cars, and electricity under the ground, all that sort of stuff straight away. That's why they can't afford it. You know, the cost of providing services to people these days is enormous compared to what it was in those days. I mean, they built half houses. They call them temporary accommodation. Or they built garages. You know, I can remember one Christmas Eve, I started work at midnight, and I went to several places in Charles Road, Moorbank, and there was no one home, you know, each place. And I got to one, and here they all are. They had a party. And they were, in those days, they were what affectionately known as Balts. They were people from the Baltic states. And they all had their Christmas party, and they were still asleep on the floor, head to tail. I'm tripping across them, waking them up with the ice, dripping on them to get to the ice box, you know. But that's how people were, and they worked pretty hard, and they were very successful.
So a typical, like when you go and deliver, can you describe some of the other, because everything was delivered to the farms, like the lands, there weren't shopping centres. Like, so
there was the corner shop. There was the corner shop, Mum would send the kids down the corner shop to buy whatever she wanted, you know. Or, I mean, in Liverpool, there was a fellow called Stan Murgatroyd had a shop called Wellworth Store, not Woolworths, Wellworth Stores, right? And I can remember there, they used to, a good friend of my mother's used to work there, a woman called Daphne Robinson, and her main job was packaging up the sugar and the flour. You know, buying pork in bags, and they weigh it and put it in brown paper bags or whatever on the counter. You know, that's how it's changed. It's just dramatically changed. Food, and I personally think that it's changed for the worse in some ways. That the Woolworths and Coles are very convenient. I go there myself, but what they're doing to smaller shops and businesses is unbelievable, and what they're doing to the suppliers, they're just ripping it off and tearing them to pieces. It's very sad. I've heard Alan Jones a couple of times on this, and he's pretty right. I don't like him or agree with him much, but he's right about that.
Did you ever grow food yourself?
I never grow food myself. No, not really. No. I've never been a green thumb like my mother used to be, but I'm not.
So you deliver ice to these areas, and there'd be other people needing to deliver stuff as well, because it's the only way they get deliveries, yeah?
Yep, all the time. I mean, in the town, you know.
Can you describe this a bit more for me, just so we can get it? Like, imagine it, create the scene visually.
Well, you know, you'd be coming up Castle Ray Street, and not every house, when I did it, had an ice chest, because the refrigerators were taken over. Silent nights were were becoming very popular, so not refrigerators, you know, Wallstrom, Hellstrom, and you know, I'd be serving ice and the baker would be coming up behind me, and if I was early enough, I'd catch up with the milkman and that sort of stuff. Yeah, that's just how it was. Nothing exciting about it, it was just how it happened.
Was it all horse and cart, or...?
No. We went horse and cart, and the baker, there was a couple of bakers that had horse and carts. I mean, there were several bakeries in Liverpool. Williamson had a bakery in the main street. Murray's had a bakery that wrapped behind them into Northumberland Street. And then Fitzpatrick's had the bakery, which later on Williamson had bought around on the in Turner Street and Scott Street.
What about some of the pubs there? Did you drink in the pubs?
No, I didn't drink. I had a truck that delivered the beer to Liverpool, so I delivered beer to the RSL and the railway, the commercial, the Golden Fleece, the Mains Bridge and the Collingwood.
That's a pretty important delivery, isn't it? Yeah. Where did you pick that up from?
Both Toos and Toos in Sydney.
So you go down South Downing.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you describe that for me? Like, the pickup and
You get in early in the morning, get in a queue, wait to get your kegs, and they drop them on the back of your truck. You roll them up and stand them up and stack them too high and all that sort of stuff.
So it's all kegs?
Oh, no, there was also bottles. The bottles were the Kent Brewery, which was Anna Tilly's and a woman. But the Kent Brewery was the one that I saw on the paper the other day they're going to develop now, Broadway. Yeah. Yep.
So what beer were you delivering? What brands?
I delivered Tui's and I delivered Rishas and Toos and Old, Toos Old. As far as bulk's concerned, and all the in those days the bottles were either KB or Pilsner, or you know, these days there's a multitude of brands, isn't there? But there wasn't really many. Tui's flag.
I'm not a drinker, but you don't drink?
I do now, but not very much. I didn't drink until I was about 30. So,
Did you ever deliver out there to the Green Valley Hotel, where I grew up?
I did. Only on one occasion for some reason. I can't remember going there once. Yep.
When the new estate opened up?
Yeah, I knew the estate. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was on the council when they opened the estate up, basically.
Okay, that's interesting.
Sorry?
That's interesting.
Yeah, because it was opened up. It was opened up to be without sewer.
I know.
And it was opened up with no playing fields or anything else. And all this land around the creeks was given to the council and said, go for your hardest, and a lot of playing fields were made, built out of that. Engineer of the day was pretty good and did a good job. And
do you know who owned the land?
It was a couple of people. Johnson's owned the land, owned most of it. They sold that and they moved down on the Northern Road and they started the dairy there, which now belongs to Parrish. And the other fellow that owned a fair bit of it was Alf. He was a bachelor. I can't think of his name. There was two. There was two main properties, And in this end, up the Liverpool end, there was the back end of Ireland's Dairy too. There's a few acres of the other thing, where the Merivale Estate is. West of there.
So some of the decision making around the housing estate, you were there while the decisions were being made about how many, who were the, can you talk about some of the contractors or how?
No, I can't tell you. I don't know.
What are some of your memories of some of that? Because that's very important part.
I can remember that it wasn't to be sewered, and Jack Mannix, to his credit, insisted that it be sewered, the mains were put in that allowed no expansion further west. That was always a deterrent for many, many years for any further development out towards my father-in-law's place, for instance. It finished basically at Banks Road, I think, Green Valley, from memory. If it was a 8-inch main there, it was a 12 or 14 inch main at the other end towards Liverpool. You know, it was done on the cheap, and subsequently, Liverpool paid a price for their development for that for a long, long time.
In what regard?
Well, there was no more development. There couldn't be, because you couldn't get sewer. You had to get sewer to be able to develop. You know, that was the rule, and that's fair enough.
What else do you remember around that time? Because it was quite a significant shift in population, wasn't it, really?
Huge.
I mean, because I was one of them. So
huge variation.
It was extraordinary, really.
I remember there were a lot of good people there, too, that did a lot of work for the young people. Andy Millen was one. Have you ever heard that name before? He used to organise soccer for kids and that sort of thing. It was very, very good. To some degree, some of it was a bit of a dumping ground, wasn't it?
It was a great area, though. I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I mean, it was great.
Yeah.
Great community.
I agree with you.
I had a great time.
And
great people.
Had some friends living there. You know. Can I just be excused for a minute?
Yeah, of course. I'll pause you.
He ran for council in 1966 too.
Did he?
Yeah. He's a funny man. Anyhow, I can't remember his name. Alright.
Yeah. Just trying to think. Just trying to jog your memory again, because you go on a... You got lots there. I've got to try and tap it somehow.
Oh. Alright.
Well, who else did you deliver for in Liverpool? Like, you would have seen... Like, so you delivered to the pubs. That was quite interesting. That came out of...
the pubs and the clubs, yeah.
And then you're on the council the time that the Green Valley was...
Yes.
Launched, let's say.
Well, it was launched just before I was on the council, but it was certainly in its infancy when I was on the council.
Yes, because we were there in 63, we moved there.
Yeah, so it was before that, but it was certainly a place full of problems when I was on the council.
The
problems as far as where the kids could play and all sorts of things, transport and all sorts
schools.
Of issues. Yeah, the whole thing
So what did you, Gough Whitlam was the federal member around that time.
Yeah.
Did you have any dealings with him?
Yeah, I had a fair bit of dealings, actually.
Yeah?
Edward Gough Whitlam.
Mm-hmm.
My father, as I told you, was a mayor, a Labor mayor of Liverpool. Subsequently, he changed. And then he had a blue with him and all sorts of trouble. However... as a kid, I remember the night of Gough Whitlam's pre-selection, going to his house in Cronulla with my mum and dad, his pre-selection, before he's elected, and he made a speech and told them that they had elected a future Prime Minister of Australia. So he was hell-bent on it from that early stage, and that was, the night that Bert Lazzarini died, there was a member before him. I remember my father went to see him, see Mrs. Lazzarini, and I went with him. That was about 9. Oh, geez. I don't know. I think it was... it would have been 49 or 50 or something. I can't remember exactly, but in that time. And they lived down Cabramatta Way. And then went to the pre-selection, as I just told you. So, yes, Gough is... he's a funny bloke. You know, my father opposed him once, not because he ever had a chance of meeting him, but mainly to keep him occupied. And when my father had a bad accident, he broke his neck and was dying. He was then overseas as the, where was he? Ambassador UNESCO or something, some overseas, I can't remember what. My phone rang and my girl said, "There's a bloke on the phone," says, "It's Gough Whitlam." I said, "Yeah, probably is." And he rang up to see how far there was. You know, he's a strange bloke. And then later attacked him after he was dead, which I was a bit disappointed about. But that was mainly as a result of the work of one Mark Latham, who set him up with some information that was incorrect, but it's a long story. Have you spoken to Mr. Latham?
No.
He's about my age.
Yeah.
He grew up the road. He played rugby with my brothers. I've only met him once.
Bit of a thug, he is, many in his life.
It's a shame, but he got a lot. The community did a lot for him.
Yes.
You know, we.
And so did the Labor Party. Look how he paid him back.
That's what I mean. You know, I wish I would have had my education paid for, but you know what I mean? Like, he was given a lot of opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a character assassin.
He's not real well.
Sorry?
He's not very well in his head sometimes.
No, I think he's a character assassin.
So how did your father break his neck?
A car accident, coming out of a council meeting. Hit a tree on Elizabeth Drive. Went out the door. He had a new Mercedes, and he went out the door of his car, didn't have his seatbelt on. Little mark on his back like that. Just a little mark there. Anyhow, he was paralysed from the head in. You know, the first night, he could throw his arms around. They took him to the hospital, and then they land a helicopter and flew from there to Ron on the shore. We had to put our lights around the thing, chopping the land there. There was no bad in there. No. And anyhow, he was throwing his arms around and pulling this tracking thing, they put him, not a tracking down his nose, you know, the police. Anyhow, the bruising went up instead of down, which meant he was quadriplegic, and he lived for 15 weeks. We sat there 15 bloody weeks, and it just went on and on. He just wasted away, basically.
Was that in Liverpool Hospital?
No, Royal North Shore, intensive care in Royal North Shore. He was for 15 weeks.
They did a spinal, don't they?
It was a spinal unit, yeah. And that was, because he's returned back to repat, looked after him. It was unbelievable. Good. Anyhow, it's life.
And what about your mum?
Still here.
She's still alive.
In this house. She's 94.
Really? Where did she grew up? Where?
Well, when they got married, she was living at Croydon Park. I think basically the Auburn and that area, that general area. You know. He was a bike rider, see? And they used to race at Pratton Park, and she went even at Pratton Park there. He basically got his start in business in money he won at a press of bike riding. He was pretty good.
The money he
earned as a professional bike rider.
Oh, yes.
Started him off in the fruit business and the ice business. Yeah.
What sort of man was your dad? Was your father?
Aggressive. I suppose you could say that. He was aggressive.
Because you're both leaders, so he must have, you know, he was obviously a leader. He did.
Oh, yeah. Well, then.
It's familiar.
Yeah.
Okay, so where are we going now? So what's ahead for you? You going to stay here?
Yep. I'll leave you in a box. I'm not moving. I mean, it's actually been rezoned for housing, but I don't want to move. The road comes up through here somewhere, another one comes back out through the house now this way. But I'm not stopping development by staying here because the road finishes there and finishes there.
Beautiful ceilings. Did you build this house?
I designed it and built it. Yep, drew the plans and built it, yeah.
A lot of people build their homes, like a lot of the guys at Austral, a lot of the men.
I didn't physically lay the bricks, but
no.
I mean, yeah, but I had it built, you know. I employed people and I built it.
Yes. Yeah. And when did you first move here again in Narelle?
It was 25 years ago.
Yeah, so you've seen some change.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I first moved to the area in 1968, if you like, and there was no traffic lights. There was, you know, none of this around here. You know, it was just incredible. The development's been fantastic, you know. Dramatic, really.
Incredible.
Yeah.
That's why we're doing this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because
yep.
trying to film every street, trying to, you know, that's, things are going to change and radically, aren't they?
Yep.
Transformed.
Yep.
From, so where's the edge going to end?
Where does what?
Fringe, where's the fringe going to keep going, really?
Well, I don't know where it's going to end. Mm. I mean, there's still an awful lot of country that's not developed.
Mm.
An awful lot, you know. But whether we've got the water and the sewage capacity, and I suppose we can always get the power generation capacity, but you know, I don't know where it's going to end.
And it's expensive, isn't it?
Oh, I mean,
to build.
It's expensive to build, and the development costs are just enormous, and the frustration of trying to do something. You know, I've got 3 parcels of land. I bought 1,500 acres in the Blue Mountains, which was the old chest hospital. This is called, you know, with a view to maybe redeveloping it as a unit, you know. The brick walls that get thrown up. In the end, I throw my hands up and said, let's get rid of it. I'll put it on the market, put it and sell it. I've got 1,200 acres at Madden's Plains, which is south of Helensburg and north of Wollongong. Yeah. Looked out over the sea, see the buildings of Sydney from it. Beautiful block of dirt. It has 7 blocks, it's in 7 titles. I applied to council they don't want us to subdivide it, righto. We applied to council to build a home on each of those blocks. We ended up in the Land Valuation Court, got ruled out on the basis that a bushfire would affect the houses. So I'm strapped with that. I've got 100 acres of Glenlea, which the government wants, and the government has declared employment lands. Right? So you'd think that'd be pretty simple. It's only zoned rural because it's got a coal washery in it, you know, and my trucks are there. It's really industrial, you know. So they said, well, you've got to apply to council, right? But you better incorporate the waste service and to pay these land adjacent. And put in a joint place. We've done that. We've spent $800,000 so far. $800,000. You got that combined, and we're further away than Walla Walla. We got something like 112, I think it was, pages back from council of questions. I mean, everybody is trying to protect everyone else's bum. And no one wants to get anything done. And it just goes on and on. I mean, why? You know, I can understand the frustration. I'm not a developer, but I can understand the frustration of developers and people that want to do things. There's just so much red tape. It's unbelievable. I mean, to go back to Liverpool for a minute, my man got on very well with a bloke called Colonel Anderson, was in charge of Morby. TBOD, he's in charge of. So he organised for the army to go out there and knock the trees down in those roads in Austral that were there but not formed and build roads. And the bloody army built them as an exercise. Just imagine trying to get someone to do it today. Impossible. Big Park. You know Big Park in Liverpool? That was a paddock. I remember seeing, in fact, I played football on it. I played soccer there at school. I remember seeing a rugby league match where the RSL played the old Liverpool football club there. Okay, went back to Anderson again, and they dug soil out up the river, which I probably shouldn't have done, carted it to there, and they built Big Park and created a park, you know. Just think of the environmental issues to try and do something like today. The approvals you've got to get. It's unbelievable. So... The cost of it. I mean, it's just unbelievable. I mean, okay, look at how it's going in here. To behind my home now, there's a subdivision going in there. You know, in the older days, they followed the contour of the land, they built the roads, they built the houses. these days they reshape the whole bloody place, you know. They dig it all up, they put it down, they compact it again and change the shape. I suppose it's all nice and beautiful. It all costs money. And the houses that are built in other parts of Liverpool that weren't treated like that are just as... And Green Valley is an example. Up and down hills or whatever, you know. down Maxwell Avenue, up Maxwell Avenue, all that sort of stuff.
Guernsey Street I grew up in, that was pretty kind of high.
Well, I mean, does it really matter? You've got to spend millions changing the landscape to make it look more aesthetic or something? I don't understand. I don't think I've been here too long.
Too much money, maybe. I don't know. It's silly.
Been here too long. So look, the frustrations, and even the frustration of the workplace today, you know, it's the same thing. It's just some of the rules you've got to live with and put up with are just unbelievable.
I remember hearing, you know, in 2005 I did this project in Bringelly around that area. Some of the farmers and you know, they were going through a lot, just not being communicated, like the stuff that was going on for them at the state and local level, just the misinformation spent, you know, the taxes, the costs, the building houses, and then they find out they're going to get a railway line running through their properties, you know, after they just built the house, passed by council.
That's right.
Just never ending. It's interesting, the structure, I had a read of it out the front that you've got here.
Like, structure.
Well, sorry, you've got a round circle and you've got convict bricks.
Oh, yes.
So, can you just talk to me about that? Like, because it must be important for you, because...
That was at my father's home at Badgery Street. And when he died, it was actually probably belonged to my father and myself. We joined tenants. Tenants in common, whatever the rule is. And the day he died, it became mine, basically. And Mum was there, and... my boys stayed with her for a couple of years, every night, you know, until I built this place. And then, so that was there, and what it is the bricks from the fence of the old Liverpool Hospital, State Hospital, which was an old men's home, basically. You know about that, do you? Yeah, where the old men used to live in there and that sort of stuff.
Tell me about that.
Well, when I grew up, there'd be guys, not all of them old either, drunks mainly, in army greatcoats wandering around the town. Some of them nothing underneath them, they'd be at the gate swinging open and urinating in the street and that sort of caper, and buying wine at the wine shop and going into Murgatroyd's shop and buying metho and drinking that and all that sort of stuff.
So the alcoholism was quite prevalent.
Yeah, they weren't just Liverpoolites, they were brought in, that was it.
Why? Into that hospital,
see.
So
and they would wander on the train line and get killed quite regularly. Like one a week type thing, you know. Eventually, my father took photographs of them with the front of their coach apron and sort of stuff, you know, and did a real job on them as the mayor and got them moved to Lidcombe. There's the home of Lidcombe.
So the home that was built, so the home was, what was it called?
The State Hospital.
Okay.
And Dr. O'Brien was the doctor in charge of them, and you could go and visit him, and he'd get a private practice also in the State Hospital, right? Subsequent to that, they got approval for a hospital. We built there, and it was a temporary hospital, an army hospital, plonked there. A couple of the buildings burned down subsequently, and they made out of aluminium and stuff that really took off. It was a horrific fire I've ever seen. It. But they also had another building there, which was called the Blue Room. So when they got approval, I go back to my father again, he was the chair of the hospital board, first hospital, you know. We're all down there cleaning up, Yana's organising, cleaning up the place, and we found a body in behind, in the back of this decomposed body, been there for yonks, in this blue room, in behind a lot of furniture and stuff. The bloke crawled in there and died, no one ever missed him. That's what it was like. It was a dreadful place. It was really a dreadful place. So to answer your question, that's what that was, and the a stone on top of that, on that there's a part of the old cow and a courthouse fence that we bought, and that's the stone pillars that are coming in my driveway.
And the Prime Minister?
Oh, well, we had a couple of visitations out there at Battery Street. And Father was the quote Ernie Smith, the late Alderman of Liverpool Council, he liked stainless that had vote cards. So he would have around this garden, several places, there's plaques under trees. There's one there from Harold Roll, I think, and might have been his missus, I think. So when I came here, the only tree that was here was that gum tree just there, and I carted 57 trees from Badgerys Creek around Rhys Adam. And so Gordon, that was a Gordon, was it, at Park, you read it? Yeah, well, we had him at Badgerys Creek at a function for about 300 people, and he unveiled the bloody plaque, I suppose. Yeah.
So what happened with Badgerys Creek?
Became part of the airport.
Yeah.
Now it's nothing. It's just sitting there. But again, the government of the day, don't ask me, it was in power, I can't remember exactly, but it was a Labor Party in power, but I can't remember which one. Well, it was Hawke, I think. They decreed that they were going to buy the land, you know, so I went straight to the solicitor and said, right, I'll tell them it's for sale. They ignored me. I couldn't get to first base, and they bought all the little blocks around Badgerys Creek. There were half acre blocks and 1 acre blocks. You couldn't build a house in there. They built all there. Then the Legion of Freshmen, they bought 87% or something of the properties for Badgerys Creek, which was total bulldust. Yeah. So they couldn't buy it. So I had a blue with my solicitor, and subsequently found a guy that would take them on. I watched the TV one night, and there was a story about mining in Kakadu, and the company had taken the government on and beat them under the denial of natural justice. So I took the federal government on, and the judge had heard of Mr. Justice Einfeld, who's now curling his heels in the calaboose, you know. But he was very good to me. He ruled that they could. So our argument was that they couldn't blight the land by putting a restriction on it and stopping us from selling it, because that's what they basically done. So you can, the old English law says you can force them to treat. So we took them on, this bloke took them on for me. So Einfeld, the federal government said, look, we haven't got to be here because, you know, we're the federal government. He said, you better be here. I adjourned for a fortnight to come back and make a decision. They come back and anyhow, they made me an offer, and I said no. And they took it back to Einfeld. He said, go away and make a more meaningful offer. And they did, and I sold it. So that's what happened after them. So it's still there. It was the headquarters at one stage. It was on Elizabeth Drive there, you know. It was 120 acres.
So we might leave it there for the day.
All right.